talking miraculously with Ernest Lowe, and today is the 22nd, 23rd of October in 1994. I'd better put this in case somebody is transcribing it 20 years from now. In the unspeakably gorgeous hills of Berkeley, what we all aspired to back in those days, and to which so many remarkably have attained. Anyway, there we are, I want to start the way that I've started with everybody else that I've talked to, because it's proved to be so fruitful, which is just to ask, how did you happen to first become involved with KVFA?
It was really through Alan Rich, who was music director there then.
Really?
Yeah.
God, I never knew that.
Yeah, he and Grace and I were close friends, and
I told you I'm talking to him in a couple of days.
Yes.
Well, I didn't know you had any.
I want to get a number for him.
Yeah, right.
Pull this out to remember. I had gone to never mind where I'd gone to. I was looking for a media related job. I'd had training in documentary filmmaking and documentary photography, and it felt very appealing to work at KPFA. I'd always been listening to it since I'd first come to Berkeley in '53, and so I came in through his good auspices, initially a production job, first couple of years. Which
so you actually went to work on the paid staff.
Yeah.
At this point, without passing through an endless no man's land of
voluntary. Right. And then,
was it actually he who hired you, or was this he that introduced you?
I can't even remember who it was that hired me. I think it was a place a time when production was in very bad shape and tapes weren't moving.
Do you remember when it was? The year?
Yeah, 1960.
1960.
Yeah.
Ah, so you were there from the very beginning of the time that I started doing the subscriber dubbing service as an outside contractor.
I remember that happening a fair amount later than 1960.
Not actually.
Oh, okay.
Because one of the first things that I had to do was to make those endless copies of the 1960 HUAC hearings.
Mm-hmm.
So that was definitely
1960.
I did the whole set for Congress when they subpoenaed them, because they realized that they hadn't made any arrangements for recording and that they really ought to. And please, KPFA, could you furnish us with some copies that we'll pay for?
Filthy scum that you are.
Yeah.
So I went over and took photographs of the hearings themselves. Unfortunately, I wasn't there the day of the Great Revolt and the sweeping of people down the stairs with fire hoses. But
were you there for the memorable, now legendary William Mandel speech? Et cetera, or cooperate in any
right.
way you are insane.
Right.
Anyway, right. So that's where that's the point at which you you came onto the staff, and I think Chris Koch was your sort of boss as the production director,
At one point, I was production director, and I was very poorly organized at doing that, and ultimately that got switched.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and. I talked to Chris in Washington just a couple of weeks ago.
Uh-huh.
I traced him down. Do you know about what he's been doing?
No.
Well, it's amazing how few people do know, because off in his corner of the world, he has been for a number of years, and particularly the last 10 years, a very distinguished television documentary producer, mm-hmm. With loads of stuff, his own company, Koch TV Productions, that's been going for 10 years or so. He's there sitting behind him on the shelf as I interviewed him was a row of awards and statuettes that I wouldn't have wanted to have to carry off in one load. Mm-hmm. And he's just finished a documentary that got a lot of attention on the Normandy invasion for Discovery Channel. Hmm. Which they have put out as a commercial release on video, which he told me he thought was perhaps the best thing he had ever done. So Chris, although a few thousand miles away, has not been idle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, last time I saw him, he was a hippie film mm-hmm. producer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, well, he told me the story of that. or his evolution. He went back to New York and tried to get a job, and nobody would hire him. And he was walking down the street one day, and he said to himself, why is everybody so hung up on my beard and long hair? And then the next question he said to himself was, why am I so hung up on my beard and long hair? And so he shaved and had his hair cut, and within a very few months he had a job. So there's a lesson there for us all. Anyway, yes, another thing I wanted to ask you, it was not straight in my mind, because Chris went back to New York just sort of at the point that I joined the station as a staff member, as opposed to just an outside mm-hmm. contractor. Was it you or he who hired me for the job?
I think it was me. Yes. It's all vague at this point.
Yeah. Well, he was a bit vague as well, and I'm a bit vague. So, anyway, to one of the two of you, I owe the total alteration of my life.
Okay.
But now you were at what point? You know, you were in production, so that your primary official job, I presume, was some of the things that you passed on to me, including things like continuity and control room operation and overseeing the technical part of the station. At what point did you begin to become involved in the production of programs?
Oh, from the beginning. I started creating programs in the 60s just as a sidebar to my main activity, mm-hmm. and did a documentary on the colonization of the Congo was my first one, mm-hmm. It was either that or one on civil defense.
So we were at the point where I was asking you when you started producing programs, starting to tell me.
Yeah, I was producing from the beginning. Early I did several just kind of voiced documentaries. One was just taking a RAND Corporation report on civil defense, which was really hair-raising mm-hmm. stuff at that point. And Chris Koch and Fred Haynes and I had gotten quite wrapped up with the idea of civil defense as an incredible sham, and had even gone out to demonstrate at a civil defense meeting in Livermore. The activist component of the work we were doing was always central. At the point that we're talking about in the early 60s, you know, we were setting off 100 megaton above ground blasts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Bye-bye. And you.
My wife was one of the charter members of Women for Peace, precisely mm-hmm. because that was going on, and there was strontium 90 in our milk, in our mm-hmm. children, going into our children's bones.
Yeah.
And so you know, at that point, at least in Berkeley, there was just a phenomenal awareness of what the level of threat in the world was.
And that's finally coming out in television documentaries, mm-hmm. Which we see over in England produced here, of what was known at the time about the atomic pollution, mm-hmm. and the people who suffered from it, but nobody ever got an official chance to hear about it.
Well, one of my partners grew up in Utah and was downwind from nuclear releases from Hanford, where there would be emissions purposely vented as an experiment. He was downwind when the wind was blowing from another direction, from the Nevada test grounds, where there were above-ground tests happening. And he was downwind from Idaho National Energy Lab, which was another major nuclear facility. And 2 years ago, he went through a throat cancer episode with no other causation possible than that being a downwinder was the cause of it.
Oh boy, well, there yeah. we are. Now I want to. Is there anything else that you want to slip in here before we get to Sometimes You Work a Day?
I think something about the openness of the station at that point, the ability to. For people to walk in the door and get on the air was really mm-hmm. phenomenal, and there was a real receptivity. You know, there would be a filtering, but from so many different directions, and there was always a courting and a watching for the people from the right, who were indicative of where the right was going, and the sense of it being a very open forum was one of the things I was very proud of. You know, I would be pinning the lapel light mic on Casper Weinberger to give the official Republican, California Republican mm-hmm. view of the world in those yeah. days.
Casper Weinberger was in those days legitimately describable as a liberal Republican.
Oh yeah.
And Dick Moore, whom I talked to, you remember Richard Moore?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I went up to Point Arena, where he now lives, and we talked for 13 hours.
Wow.
Split over 2 days.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things he said in the course of that was that one of his saddest personal memories was watching Cap Weinberger gradually deteriorate into an apparatchik for Reagan mm-hmm. and for the administration,
yeah.
and
yeah.
just a transformation into a totally different person.
Yeah. So you know, and putting on, you know, one moment I'd be putting on Herbert Aptaker tapes or Dorothy Healy tapes, and another moment it'd be William Buckley or Rusher. I forget William Rusher, two of the doyens of the right, and it felt that stretch of the mind was really important, and at times at least the debates and dialogues would have that expanse.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that has certainly changed. There's no longer a felt obligation mm-hmm. to have right-wing opinion on the station, and it's legitimized by the position that one gets so much of it in the other media that mm-hmm. there's no point in putting it there.
But then that reinforces the progressives' insularity.
Mm-hmm, yeah, it also makes it impossible to have a dialogue among and between mm-hmm. these people. Because that was one thing that did happen on KPFA. Yeah. One got them not only in this slot and in that slot, but from time to time coming into the same room and talking with each other.
I fear that the fragmentation in the intellectual culture is so profound that we have people in radically different worldviews, different understandings of reality, that really make dialogue impossible. And I don't have any particular answer for that. But if over here we have someone who believes that the Earth was created 5,000 years ago, and over here we have someone who has a fairly scientifically based view of the very long history of the world, those are very radically different realities.
Yeah. And you also run into trouble when trying to pursue the lines that KPFA always did pursue of representation to black activists. It's difficult to carry on a dialogue with a group of people who are firmly convinced that the Egyptians were African, were black rather than Semitic, and that they invented everything from the computer to the Sten gun.
Mm-hmm. We have many little realities scattered around the landscape, mm-hmm. and many different histories, mm-hmm. with just a radical gulf between them.
Yeah. At the same time, KPFA and the other stations continue to broadcast somebody who I think is one of the most seminal thinkers about political matters at the moment, namely Noam Chomsky. And he's there regularly.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
And he is at least some kind of a meeting point for a whole lot of people who can say, yeah, I dig Noam Chomsky. That's something.
Yeah.
And I think I already said I found Larry Minsky straight-minded, a very comprehensive person who has the mind of a Talmudic scholar, in the persona of an aging hippie, it's handy for him, but. I wanted a little detail about Sometimes You Work a Day, mm-hmm. partly because that is one of the programs I want to get into the structure. Whether I end up doing CD-ROM or if it's a book, which must have a CD attached to it, mm-hmm. for excerpts. Otherwise, the whole thing is going to be like a textbook on Renaissance art without any reproductions in it.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes just an exercise in how eloquent I can be in trying to verbally recreate on a page something which happened to sound coming out of a loudspeaker.
Yeah.
So you got a grant for that, didn't you?
No, that was
oh my God.
Vacation time.
I got a hummingbird. I haven't seen a hummingbird.
Oh, yeah.
Wow, amazing! There was no grant for that.
There was no grant whatsoever. I'd heard an interview with one of the photographers from the 30s. I forget who that was now. And I was taking a class with one of the Farm Security Administration photographers before I came to KPFA. And when I heard that the conditions were unchanged, but basically that what these great photographers in the 30s had been documenting, that you could find the same scenes that there in the 60s, I decided I wanted to do photographs. And then when I started working at KPFA, I knew I want to, and heard those Parker documentaries from, I always associate them with Ewan McCall and Peggy Seeger.
They were the presenters.
Right. When I heard them and just the power of people telling their own story, mm-hmm. I decided that I wanted to do documentary that enabled the farm workers to tell their story.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started going out, taking my vacation time for it. I'd use some KPFA time, but most of that work was me going up and down the San Joaquin Valley and the Salinas Valley, photographing, took something like 5,000-6,000 photographs in all, and
did
recording
you, did you ever did you ever have a chance to assemble that as any kind of photographic essay and
yeah.
public exhibit?
Yeah, in 1966, I had a multimedia exhibit at De Young Museum.
God, that was the year after I left
right.
Berkeley.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, had a fairly large gallery, and great good fortune to work with Zach Stewart and Dan Osborne, two architects who Zach had been doing multimedia shows and helped, you know, gave the design concept for the exhibit. We had many photographs up, large photographs, and then hundreds of 8x10s. He said, let's not bother doing a fine selection. Let's decide what to put up in 3x4 foot and form up to that, and then mm-hmm. use lots of these other images. They're such powerful images. Let's mm-hmm. saturate the environment. Then I created a tape that had both farm workers' voices, farmers' voices, people singing in the fields, all that sort of thing.
And this was totally separate from the program.
Arranged
in a different manner.
Pretty much, you know, without trying to get a logical sequence, I knew it was mm-hmm. would be a more random hearing of it. Mm-hmm. And then documents and...
And you still have that, hopefully. The tape that you put together for the exhibit.
I don't.
You don't?
No.
Does anybody?
I don't know.
You don't know. Right. Okay.
So it was a soup. And then we created a shack interior to put up two walls, and I went down and found an abandoned cabin, farm worker's cabin, and carried all the ingredients up. Someone had either died or walked away for some reason, and there were the long johns over the end of the bed, the boots with the socks hanging out from under them, the food on the shelves. And so we had this little slice of life at one end of the gallery, with documents hung on the outer walls of it, congressional testimony from the 30s, letters that I'd found in trash heaps, the DiGiorgio Corporation annual report for one day, until someone screamed. The exhibit was canceled about 2 months, month and a half before it was to go up, because someone on the board said, my friends in the DiGiorgio family will not like this. And I used KPFA contacts, principally Father Eugene Boyle, to work, you know, I just worked the network and got word back to the board of the De Young Museum that if the exhibit was canceled, there would be a citywide exhibit in storefronts all over the city. The exhibit, the De Young, canceled, censored.
Oh, boy.
And so they put it back on.
Oh,
they decided
my God.
They didn't want that bad press.
So how long was it up?
It was up for, I think, four to 6 weeks. I don't remember precisely.
So you had a good, healthy run.
Yeah.
That's terrific. Have you ever considered the possibility of trying to get the materials of that exhibit into CD-ROM format?
No.
Because that is, I don't have to tell you, I'm sure you know, CD-ROM is very...
Yeah.
They're crying out for material. And I would think that would be an absolute natural. I mean, presumably you've got photographs.
I gave all of my negatives and photographs to the Open Museum, so they're on archive there.
They're available.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I want to plant that in your head and think about it, because we're now talking not about not just about contemporary documentary. We're talking about history.
Yeah.
It's 30 years ago.
Yeah.
It's and there's as you know, there's great there's great fascination with that period and, mm-hmm. and with those issues and with those people. And I think you could, quite aside from the moral aspects, I think you could have yourself a little winner there. Mm. Think about it. So anyway, that was all done without any kind of financial backing, other than the fact that you had a job.
Right. Yeah. A very high-paying job.
Well, yes. Yeah. As I recall,
take-home pay was something on the order of $350 to $400 a month.
Yeah. I remember. By the time I left, I worked myself up to almost $5,000 a year.
Mm, yes.
Oh, God. That magic break point. But then I went over to England at a point where people who had jobs there out of university felt that they had done very well if they could get as much as £1,000 a year as a salary, and. It was the case that going over and starving in London was fairly easy after having worked at KPFA for several years. So what? How long did it take you to put Sometimes Workaday together?
I started taping in December of 1960. And as I recall, it took about, the whole process was about a year of going out and taping, then going through these hours and hours of tape to find the nuggets and trying to get things up to a quality that could be comprehended. Often the recordings would be very bad. At one point I was traveling around with a little... A plug-in WebCore recording that was recorder that was really awful quality.
Not wire.
It wasn't wire, no. So I became a master of sucking sound out of mush.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the good old Pultec equalizer.
Right. The process of talking with the people was extraordinary for me. My own roots were in Oklahoma. My dad was from Oklahoma, and so I didn't recognize at the time how much this was going back to roots for me. But there was just something so comfortable about hanging out with both the Yarkies and the Blacks. The Chicanos were a little
more distant
from me.
So you didn't feel as if you were mixing with total strangers?
No. It really did have a home feeling to me. And I discovered, at the very end of my time what sort of interviewer I was. A very great psychologist of that period, Carl Rogers, had a whole style of counseling that was based on listening very, very well and asking very open questions and giving very little direction, and that was the way I would interview.
Yeah. It went under the name of non-directive counseling.
Right, and that was precisely the way I would interview. So there was an open space, and people, would get out of the answering questions mode and into their own voice. And that's what I was always listening for.
A friend of mine some years before in Stockton when I was at College of the Pacific, who worked as a non-directive counselor, had a portrait of himself that a friend had done with his face on it, but in the form of a draped blanket. Just sort of hung from a point here, and just sort of down onto the floor, and the folds of it sort of formed themselves into his face. He was very fond of that.
Well, I think I wasn't quite that neutral. my first approach, I felt so inarticulate at that point in my life, and particularly, crossing boundaries, even though I was from working class background, I fancied myself intellectual felt very distant culturally. And so I'd walk up to someone with my camera in front of me and my tape recorder over my shoulder and say, I'm from the city and I've been hearing about what's going on down here with farm workers and I think you're all getting a raw deal and I want people to know about it. Would you be willing to talk with me and let me photograph? You know, so the activist approach, which I think was very characteristic of KPFA, you know, was right there from the get-go. I would approach farmers now and then, and that was actually a much more difficult conversation for me.
Because
I try to go into disguise and present myself as an objective reporter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No way.
Yeah. Where did you live during these?
In the Berkeley Flats.
When you were in the field.
I'd sleep in a sleeping bag out along the river farm worker campsites. Sometimes I'd stay with a friend. There was a guy who edited the San Joaquin Valley Labor Journal. I'd stay at his place sometimes. And then my family had a ranch down in the foothills, cattle ranch, far into the valley. I'd stay there sometimes, depending on where I was going.
To some extent, you went native, as it were, like brief periods of time.
Yeah.
And did you finish putting it together within this time period you're talking about, or up to 62?
I guess it was spring of 62 that I got it mm-hmm. together.
Yeah. So it was finished just before I came in onto the staff.
I guess.
Yeah. That's sort of my memory. Well, what did this lead to? So far as programming is concerned, I'm not talking about controversy. Mm-hmm. What other programs did it lead to?
In that vein, I wanted to do voices for other people who normally are not heard, and so I became interested in the urban renewal project, which was quite controversial because it was displacing many poor people in West Oakland, and went out and did. For instance, this wasn't documentary form so much as just a panel discussion among a bunch of black women on welfare in that area, and then editing it down into a more compact form, but trying to keep the basic continuity of their communication. Went out once with Saul Landau to do an interview with a documentary on Skid Row and people living on Skid Row in San Francisco. Remember early in, very early in the Vietnam sequence, he and I going out and just interviewing people, classic man on the street interview, do you know what's happening in Vietnam? Sort of along that theme. Also, I think it was in late 63, I did a series of studio documentaries just taking from Congressional Record, where Ernst Greening and Wayne Morse were filling the back of the record with documentation of what was going on in Vietnam at a time when it still hadn't started hitting the headlines very much. KPFA was covering regularly.
Yes, I was talking to Scott Keach about this just a couple of nights ago at some length, and of course he was in the middle of that as well.
So I would put together a documentary that would draw from many sources, and by doing collage, you could get a better picture of what was happening. There'd be a snippet in a New York Times story that you'd put together with something picked up by Wayne Morse from Aviation Weekly, mm-hmm. that you'd put together with something from Eye of Stone, mm-hmm. and it would give you triangulation that you could start to see the trend. Mm-hmm. of what was happening, and did several of those. Mm-hmm. scripted documentaries with different voices voicing.
Now, there was a point at which you actually stopped working in the production department as such, wasn't there? That was probably the point at which I became production director.
I think probably around then.
And you moved sideways into a programming position, and as we well know, one of the great station controversies was the idea of program producers who did not report directly to a department head, and it was. There was a phrase, I can't remember, that was used to describe, I don't mean an insulting phrase, I mean an official phrase, that was used to describe these independent producers.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember what it was?
I don't.
No. I mean, the principal ones, again, if I remember correctly, by this point, were you and John McIntyre.
Right.
I don't think there was... There wasn't anybody else who was actually on the staff, was there?
No.
In that kind of a position. Yeah, I'm not going to try to write a blow by blow description of what went on, and you will certainly gather by now that I am not out to settle old scores as it were. I flatter myself that I'm a historian, I can't ignore, of course, the fact that this was a. This was a point of bitterness, and just looking at it as a progression of events, I see an accumulating and accelerating split within the staff, which. Took its roots from the stand that the management and the board chose to take on the SISS investigation and the FCC, that is, whether to cooperate with the with the investigation mm-hmm. or not, that decision. To do so was one which was, I don't know how to tell you, strongly opposed by Elsa, and was also strongly opposed by Chris Koch, and in retrospect is still strongly opposed by Chris Koch, without being an expert, I tend to think that KPFA. Did better in crisis than in meekness, and the line that was taken perhaps was a mistake and a softening of fiber, but I wouldn't be prepared to scream on the subject. There was also a. There was also a growing resentment on the part of program directors who felt that their authority was being usurped, or put not in quite so loaded a fashion that the structure of the station was being eroded and made amorphous to a point that it didn't. It didn't work, and there was also a feeling that some of the things that got on the air as a result of that were not all that they should have been from the standpoint of broadcast quality, although I think it was generally acknowledged that your programs were not uniformly at the highest standard, but that they were professional, and they always had things that were in them that were worth interesting, worth listening to. And I never heard anybody that said that that Sometimes You Work a Day wasn't a great program. So anyway, that's looking into it from all that way. Hey, I have a question to ask you. This is not for the book. This is strictly off the record. I'll put the record mode again.
Let me comment some on this period.
Mm-hmm. I think that's what I want.
It's a very central period.
That's what I want you to do.
Okay. What you were just describing, the split over the decision on how to respond to the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee, that's a strictly political level of difference. And what I see the real split in the station at that point growing out of was much deeper than that, and essentially it was a point of divergence between a hard, relatively Marxist-oriented political point of view and the upwelling of the what became known as the human potential movement, and which led into the hippie movement. I think of it, you know, there was this very new culture emerging. And it naturally would emerge through a focal point in the community like KPFA. And I think the deep level of the chasm that was there was, you know, very radically different worldviews and different ideas about how change happens, different ideas about what human beings are, you know, that was emerging. And of course, a blurring of lines such that someone like Saul Landau crossed the picket line during the strike. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. one of the noted New Left leaders. Mm-hmm. But he was so aligned with this new humanistic current of change thinking, you know, and still keeping it in a political form, but he was willing to cross the picket line. Mm-hmm. As my memory serves me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad to hear you say this because what I want to do in print is turn this off. I'm not going to waste time. As I remember, during this period, Bob Schutz was still around as a commentator. And sort of in and out of the station, and he had a, you know, been profoundly embedded in the structure of the place earlier on, and my memory is that he was one of those who continued to broadcast during the strike, and supported Trevor and the administration and the rest of them, so that there was. Although Bob Schutz and I didn't have any really personal contact in particular, we were neither friends nor enemies. I recorded his commentaries from time to time, and I knew who it was. We knew each other to speak to. But if one had to pin it down, I would have to say that at the time that we parted, we were officially at some level or other opponents or enemies or what have you. In doing the first installment of this, I got in touch with Bob and interviewed him at some length over the phone, because I was not at a time when I could come over here. Mm-hmm. And in the course of all this, we became, it's fair to say, very close friends. And on my way up to see Dick Moore. I stopped off in Santa Rosa, where Bob is, and we had lunch together and a warm time and hugged each other goodbye and parted as people close to each other. And that is what has happened in every... I have not had a single remotely antagonistic encounter with anybody in the process of doing this. And one of the things which encouraged me in the outcome of what I wrote on the first 10 years is that these people I talked to, some of which had been at each other's throats, wrote to me or phoned me up from America to say that they felt that I had presented them with total fairness and accuracy, and that they had no fault to find with the persona with which I had surrounded them in the paper.
Well, as I crossed the picket line, I would hand you flowers. Do you remember that?
Ah, well, everybody handed people flowers in those days.
no, that was before the flower power time. Remember, this is 63. Okay. Isn't it 63 or 64?
And what did I do? What did I do with them?
I think that they would generally be thrown on the ground. I don't remember you in particular, your particular action, but... something I never told you was the Latin name of the flower was Scabiosa.
Oh, God. That'll go in. That's a nice touch.
I think part of the character of the strike really illustrates what I'm saying about this deeper gulf in the culture that was opening, or the progressive culture at that point. I think there was a great sense of playfulness inside, and the people on the street were playing the hard labor struggle role much more. It was much more serious and tend to be much more ill-humored, and I think that's characteristic of what then unfolded later in the 60s as the real hard activists were suddenly confronted with all these pot-smoking, acid-dropping activists. which was the trajectory that I believe the folks on the inside were aiming into. And that in the movement was a pretty sore... sense of separation, throughout the anti-war struggle, throughout the civil rights struggles, the fact that there were some people who were determined that they were not going to suffer in the midst of working for a world that works, that they were going to start making a world that works right now by the way they live. Mm-hmm. I think very, very different from the people who are into total sacrifice. Later, I was a counselor, and I had one woman who had been daughter of communist organizers in the garment industry, and her sense of how much that family was into suffering, because it wasn't right to feel good in a time when so many other people were suffering, and how hard that was to overcome, and this other current, I think, is very, very important. You mentioned when you walked in the door you live in paradise or something like that. In many ways, I live in a world where I'm acutely aware of the suffering of the world. I'm aware of the suffering of animals and plants as well as people. Mm-hmm. And I also live in a paradise in terms of my interaction with people, in terms of how I live my life. And that is such an important current in our culture, and I think you can find it everywhere.
My comment was merely geographical.
I know. Just spinning off from it.
Yeah.
Just one other comment on the strike. The folks who were inside saw what was unfolding as the classical factional battle within a progressive organization, and there had been plenty of factional battles within KPFA, and our sense was that the by that the process of unionization was really illegitimate in those terms, because it was like calling the police in on a factional battle rather than working it out in its own terms.
Yeah, I'm going to stay quiet and not attempt to debate with you because that's not the purpose of this. The purpose is to give you the opportunity to say exactly what you want to say.
I just want you to have that understanding of what was going on. You know, I think everyone inside had great respect for the labor tradition. I had produced a major documentary on the San Francisco general strike, finding folks from both sailors and longshoremen union who were still around, and there was just a sense that the unionization was taking one small part of what the struggle was about and using that to gain leverage in factional dispute. I will grant there were serious labor problems within KPFA, but all of us were subject to.
In any one instance, in any one business, that same thing would be true. A union was there in order to gain strength in a specific factional dispute of some kind.
But my sense is that the ideological issues and this deeper human split that was occurring was the real substance of debate, and that the labor issues were secondary to that. So I'm pretty sure that was what most of us felt who stayed inside the strike and who were so willing to cross picket line. You know, in part it was a sense of this new consciousness that we had no name for emerging, that we needed to really nurture. Yeah. And that the debate was trying to push that down. It was frivolous to put the Beatles on the air, for instance, on KPFA. It was one of the judgments on programming along the way. That was Nina Landau, Nina Serrano Landau's program, as I recall, the first time we ever broadcast the Beatles.
There was one which I produced, technically produced. Which was a program on the Beatles, a very witty, tongue-in-cheek literary analysis, as if done by a new critic, by an English chap who came over, I think that may even have preceded it. But that, of course, there are a couple of dimensions there. It was done within the context of wit. Actually, and this guy also did a literary critique of John Lennon's in my own right of his poetry, and did a presentation as if he were Lawrence Ferlinghetti Robert Lowell or whatever. So yeah. that had gone on, but yes, I think it is. I think it's true to say that the position of the strikers inside was representative of...
No, we were the scabs.
I'm sorry. Strike that, as it were. The position of those who were not striking was turned out to be... much closer to the direction that the station and the society took in years to come. I felt, and I think everybody else felt, that one of the things that those out there on the street were striking for was intellectual and professional standards. At a certain level, that has been a losing battle, if you call it a battle. America has departed from that. It's now a very old-fashioned position, and so As I said earlier, a Talmudic scholar like Bensky has to disguise himself as an aging hippie in order to get away with it. So this all fits in, within the context in which you state it. There's not a word that you said in that presentation that I would disagree with. I would not argue with it. I would identify it as part of a social, intellectual, emotional, structural continuity within the evolution of American society and even of American intellect, and more recently even of American scholarship, which has gone in some what looks to older scholars like very strange directions in relation to minority culture scholarship and that sort of thing. This is part of a movement in which KPFA has, with remarkable accuracy compared with other institutions, particularly aged institutions like KPFA, an accuracy with which they have reflected the torments of society during this period. So I'm just saying all this to try to give you an idea of the context within which I intend to use mm-hmm. what you've said. And well, I am
okay,
still.
Let me respond okay. to that, because that's very important. The breaking out of a hierarchical reductionist intellectual framework is part of this broad current of change in the culture, moving toward a more holistic, a more systemic, a more inclusive intellectual framework. The whole psychedelic movement is something that gave people direct experience that some people took.
I just want to give you a warning.
Yep.
That I've got both on the tape and on my watch 10 minutes
okay.
left.
Fine.
So I just wanted to give you yeah. that framework.
There was a gaining of direct experience of a holistic way of living from the psychedelics and to a lesser extent from grass. The breakup of the control of a more paternalistic worldview and intellectual framework has resulted in a fragmentation in intellectual currents, some of which are intellectually not very rigorous, others of which are intellectually highly rigorous. The whole trend into systems thinking, for instance, there are methods of organizational change in the corporate world that build on something that an acid head from the 60s would recognize as home territory, even though it intellectually it's been created from a very different base, because it's holistic, it's systemic, it's how do we work within this organization. Usually it's a corporate organization still at this point. It hasn't hit government very much. How do we work within this organization in a way that respects both the needs of all stakeholders within the company, the needs of all stakeholders outside of the company, including the natural systems as a stakeholder in this company? And this I believe is an intellectual current that was emerging into popular culture in the 60s, and that this more forward-looking current reflected within KPFA at that point. We were broadcasting the psychedelic three, Leary, Metzner, and what was Ram Dass's name before? You know, as early as 62, I believe.
Well, the KPFA was in about 1952 or 3, got into quite a bit of trouble broadcasting the discussions of a group of marijuana smokers.
Mm-hmm. Well, I remember that one. Yeah. The history of that.
Okay, while Lou Hill was out.
Yeah. So I agree with the idea that this current that I'm describing has, as some of the side currents to it, a deterioration in our intellectual life. It also includes the cutting edge of our intellectual life, where people are working with great rigor in a very new mode of thinking. And we just have to recognize that what we used to consider intellectual quality was mostly a very limited worldview. It was paternalistic, it was non-systemic, it was reductionist, and it was very hierarchical, dominating virtually every field of intellectual thought. And we're at this very long threshold in history of moving into a holistic, systemic, non-paternalistic way of thinking, way of designing, way of operating. Whether we'll make it intact, we don't know. We may be in breakdown so seriously that we destroy our habitat on Earth. We're at that decision point. We may already be past it. Mm-hmm. We don't know. Yeah. Fortunately,
well, among other things, for my sins, as they say, I'm the honorary treasurer of an organization called Global Commons Trust, out of London, and mm-hmm. and it's an attempt to set up at the moment a trust based on something called the Global Commons Institute, which consists mostly of one brilliant manic man who has been going around giving bombshell papers at ecological conferences among nations around the world, mm-hmm. and getting a lot of attention. And you can tell from the name Global Commons what sort of where it's at, as they say.